Intelligent Design Part 2 was presented by Charlie Dewberry on February 27, 2007 at McKinsey Study Center's Tuesday night class. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, well, this is the second class and the last one on intelligent design. And last week, I outlined what intelligent design was and outlined the most immediate controversy that's sort of been a milestone in the development and interaction of intelligent design with Darwin, and that was the Dover court case. And what I'd like to do this time is talk about, for just a minute, the last little piece was the effects of that court case as far as I could see. And as I say, it was the effects of that court case. That was one of two reasons why I kind of felt like I had to say something. And then tonight, what I'd like to go on and talk about is I'd like to frame the debate differently than it's been framed. And it seems to me that there hasn't really been any intelligent debate about this subject at all. Basically, you have both sides really just trying to annihilate the other and not really listen to each other. And neither side is addressing the points and counterpoints of the other side for the most part. So tonight what I'd like to do is move into what I consider the impediments to the debate and talk about what those are and what I think the debate should be about and how it should be framed. So that's where I'm intending to go tonight. But I want to stop and just ask, you know, if there's questions that you have that you'd really would like to hear an answer to, maybe I can fold that in. I'm intending to stop. I'm aiming to only talk for just a little under an hour, so the rest of the time we can interact about the issues, and there'll be a couple places even in between that to interact with some of the pieces as well. So any major questions you were hoping that we'd get to tonight? Well, that makes it easy for me to roll with it then. Okay. Well, as I say, I ended last time talking about the Dover court case where the judge basically ruled that intelligent design was not science and could not be taught in a biology class because the issue was separation of church and state. And it was inappropriate for intelligent design to be taught in a biology class. It seems to me, if you back up and look at the logic of the judge's ruling, as far as I can see, this is it. There's a philosophical position called naturalism, and it's sanctioned by the state as science. So any other philosophical position, like theism, is something else. So the effect of this ruling was we could turn it around and say, if naturalism is a philosophical system that can be used to teach science and teach about the origins of life, then why can't any other philosophical position be used to do the same thing? Or to turn this thing around, if it's true that theism, which is a philosophical position, there is no religion of theism. Theism is a philosophical position. There is no church of theism. So, turning this around, if theism in the classroom is establishing religion, then allowing naturalism into the classroom is equally establishing a religion. And the effect of this ruling is a state-sanctioned religion and biology class that's based purely on philosophical prejudice. Well, to me, this is philosophical bigotry of the worst kind. Those are two philosophical positions. It's not an issue of science versus religion. And so, to me, just to not be able to see that, and for one, the judge not be able to see it, but two, the attorneys on both sides, if you look at the court case, allowed it to get set up that way. And so they're culpable here as well. But it seems like we're culpable as a culture for not responding to this at all. And I've heard little or no response along these lines to the judge's ruling. And I don't know if you've seen, but now the judge is out on the circuit. And he acknowledged that 2 days before the court case started, he went and watched Inherit the Wind because he figured this was the next chapter of Inherit the Wind. So he's now out on the circuit talking about the, you know, being the judge on this milestone court case. What's Inherit the Wind? The Scopes trial? The movie of the Scopes trial? So anyway, I decided that needed a response, or I had to do something. So that was one of the two impetuses that I had for writing the book that I wrote on and on the intelligent design question. The other piece was there's a philosopher named Michael Roos. In fact, he was in Portland a couple weeks ago. I was unable to go, but I saw him in Corvallis about 6 months before that. He's basically, I would say, the leading Darwinian bulldog. So most of the time, he's actually travels the country at the expense of mostly Christian groups, as he points out. Nobody else will pay his fare. So he basically is brought all around the country to debate people with regard to evolution. Michael Roos his background is British. He's very charismatic. He's got an incredible sense of humor. He'll have you rolling the aisles and tears running down your face. I mean, he's a showman. It's very difficult for anybody else to be on the same platform with Michael Roos, and he's been doing it 35 years now. So he's pretty good at it. But anyway, he's the major sort of Darwinian bulldog that's out in the trenches constantly debating anybody that wants to debate these issues. And he's recognized as really the founder of philosophy of biology. He's written the two major textbooks or the two major compilations of philosophy of biology. Well, anyway, he wrote a book a year ago, and his position was, well, we all know Darwin's right, but why doesn't this problem go away? I mean, why is there still a problem? And what he was arguing was, the reason this doesn't go away is these ideas have a history. And so he basically presented a history of evangelical Christianity and basically said, because of that history, part of the reason why this won't go away is because of that history and because of the legacy. So it doesn't have anything to do with the facts of the matter. It has to do with history. But the second thing he said I found very interesting. He said the second reason why this doesn't go away is that there's a number of major proponents of Darwinianism who are actually taking a religious stance, that for them it's not a scientific theory, it's a religious perspective, and they're not acknowledging that their stance is actually a religious one. And so he said part of the reason why Christians in particular react so strongly against these outspoken Darwinians is it's actually a religion-to-religion controversy not a scientific controversy, science-religion controversy at all. It's a religion to religion. And he was pointing right at people like Dawkins, for instance, who just, as many of you may know, just wrote a book defending his position that there's really no such thing as religion, and you know there isn't really a God. And he often, in the past, I don't know if he still does, but he used to quite frequently start any remarks he makes by saying that really there isn't anyone that had a functional brain that could believe in God. So he, at times at least, has started talks with those kinds of remarks. So anyway, it was just interesting to me that Roos was actually kind of pointing his finger and saying, well, you know, that sort of response is actually why this won't go away. And anyway, I've thought that was an interesting response. As I mentioned last time, I, for the last 30 years, largely tried to avoid any of these biological creation debates because it didn't seem like to me anyone was really interested in a debate about the issues. Okay, so that was the last piece then that I wanted to wrap up from sort of the court case, the effect. And as I say, to my knowledge, little's been said about it since, as far as what the ruling has been. So what I'd like to do now is kind of shift gears and talk a little about what I think really the impediments to having a debate about this is. I mean, and the first thing I want to mention is, well, as a biologist, somebody who's worked in biology for a long time, one of the observations that I've made, and I'm not unique in this, certainly is that it strikes me that most of the people that are most interested in this issue could care less about biology. I mean, this really isn't about biology at all. So, I mean, most people really could care less what exactly is a species and where a species came from. Most people could, as I say, that issue is of little or no interest to them, really. But it's major philosophical commitments that underlie your view with regard to nature and with regard to biology. Those are the things that impassion this issue, not biology. And usually the way that's framed by both sides is this is a debate, this needs to be a debate about science. This is a scientific debate. It needs to be decided on the basis of facts. And it's in the arena of science that we need to sort this all out. Now, it seems to me both sides really believe that that's true. The proponents of intelligent design, what they want is they want a debate by the scientific community, the merits of their case, as opposed to a Darwinian case. On the other side, the scientists, they're of two minds. One mind is, well, don't say anything about it. Because if we don't say anything about it, then it's not science and we don't have to deal with it. So it's of no real interest to us. And if we just leave it alone, there's no way that it can get in and actually be debated within this arena of science. The second mind on the other side of the scientists is basically just to make the argument that the scientific community has examined the criticisms of Darwin's theory and, that are made by intelligent design, or the positive claims made by those who hold intelligent design, and point out the flaws in their methodology, and point out the fact that they don't have any peer review papers to point at that are science. So in the end, both sides, it seems to me, have a perception that this debate ought to occur in the realm of science, that this is really about facts, and it's primarily scientists that ought to sort it out. And I think that perspective is almost totally false from beginning to end. And to make my point, what I'd like to do is pass these around. I'll keep one. Okay, I'll explain this figure in just a minute, what's going on. Right now, just look at A. Now, position A is Darwin's when you get a copy of it. Now, most people, there's a number of issues here. One is, most of the time when people are debating about Darwinian evolution, they're actually not debating Darwinian evolution because they don't hold the position that Darwin held. So, for instance, in Darwin's theory, he's explicitly not talking about the origins of life. His theory is not about the origins of life. At least, the origin of species is not. In fact, he's making the same move Lyell is. And Lyell basically was the founder of modern geology. And what Lyell said was, look, what is science? Is we'll look at features out here on the landscape now, and we'll measure processes like the Dover Cliffs, these big cliffs in England. We'll measure how fast the waves erode them. And so that'll come up with a rate per year that these are moving. Well, now science is looking at those processes at the rates we see them occurring today and looking backwards and looking forwards some distance and making statements about what has been or what will be. But it is not about the origin of the Earth. It's only going back so far. So Darwin's making the same move. So, for example, in his book, he says, we're going to start with 1 to 5 species. And I'll just pick 4 here. Now, hypothetically, we could have a particular fish, an amphibian, a reptile, a bird, and a mammal. Okay, so we'll start with these 4 critters. What Darwin is saying is, and we looked at this a little bit last week, that here we have what we want to call a species or a group. Well, over time, they'll diversify. And over time, they'll diversify to the point where they're actually separate species. Okay? And we talked about that a bit last time, looking at the U.S. and a number of zones, 8 or 9, and picking a species like a frog. And all these zones could interbreed across these zones. But if you took one from here and tried to interbreed it with one over here, they no longer could interbreed. Now, so the point that's being made here is we're seeing this process of a new species being formed right in front of us. And biologists can point at thousands of those kinds of examples. Are those new species? Sure. So in Darwin's view, you just give this enough time, and now I want to erase this. And these can actually, there's a potential that this critter could essentially branch out over here and you could end up with something like a fish coming from here. His point was that there's really a continuum here. And I said last time that Darwin had made essentially a card trick. He'd switched concepts on people, part of which people have seen for a long time, but the other part very few people talk about. And I want to talk about this in detail, because here's what hinges on this. There's three positions you can take in what's called a theory of nature. One is the position Aristotle took, that in nature, there are such things as kinds. And what a kind is it's a group that has shared features. And in Aristotle's mind, a kind would be something like plants in animals. Now, in Aristotle's view, plants, they're a category. They have essential features. They're green. They all can make sugar on their own, you know, all sorts of things plants do. And then animals over here, I mean, they can move, for instance, in ways plants don't. But his point was, these are qualitatively different. Those are real kinds. So from his perspective, it's illogical and impossible that a plant could evolve into an animal. It's contradicted. That's a categorical mistake in nature. To Aristotle, that could not happen. Okay, so that theory of nature is a theory that believes there are real kinds in nature. Okay? Well, obviously, the second view doesn't believe there's real kinds out there. Everything differs by degree. Okay, so everything just kind of grades. Darwin called it a bush. Okay, it's just a bush. Everything grades. There's no real category called fish. Anybody with a philosophical background, this is what's called nominalism. What it means is the name fish, that's just a useful word we've coined to arbitrarily put together these things in this category that sort of look like fish. Well, there's a continuous grade from fish to amphibians to birds to mammals. And these are arbitrarily defined. So one of the first things Darwin did in his book is he argued that, look, if we have a species, we know there's varieties. Everybody accepts the idea there's varieties, okay? Well, varieties just differ by degree. So how does Darwin define what a species is? Darwin says, well, look, what a species is just a variation that's now more variable than a variation. So it's diversified to a larger extent than variations. So now we'll call that a species. And if you give it enough time, those species will create enough variation that we'll now call it a genus. Well, those are all arbitrary characterizations. The only thing that's real is the individual. There is no such thing as a fish. I mean, once fish gets over here, it's almost amphibian. And it just can grade right into amphibian. And this is just an arbitrary division. Yes, Kate?
Will you put a limitation on this realm versus the non-living realm? Or is there even a continuum between living and non-living?
Well, for right now, let's just talk about the living. Okay, we'll get to the point where the issue will be we'll get to the point. Well, that's the question that I raised last time. Can life be reduced to chemistry and physics? Okay, see, that issue is going to touch right here on what assumption you're making about theory of nature. Okay, Darwin holds the second position, which is called nominalism. Now, all his opponents held the first theory. He holds this position. Now, there's one more position you can hold. And actually, I'll talk just a little bit about it, because actually there's a lot of biologists who hold this position, although they wouldn't. They would claim it's Darwin's. It's actually not. And it's a Marxist position. Now, what did Marx say about theory of nature? What Marx said is, well, both these things have a little bit going for it. I mean, there's truth in both those. But here's what Marx said. Think about water. Water below 32 degrees is a solid. It's ice. But you heat it up a little bit, and it's a liquid. And you heat it up a lot, and it's a gas. Well, a solid, a liquid, a gas, those are kinds. I mean, they differ quantitatively. But what underlies them is something that varies by degree, temperature. So in other words, what a Marxist is saying is by changes in degree, you can get what are called saltations or jumps to a new sort of state. Okay? So biologists would call this saltation, that all of a sudden you can get a little change. So you can see how, you maybe you've even heard them, little changes in DNA sequences can end up with big changes. Well, that's not Darwin's view. That's Marx's view. Okay, if they're claiming it can result in big changes, so that you could actually get kinds. Now, what I want, okay, what I'd like to say now is virtually everyone who's come to this question has looked out at the world and says, boy, it sure looks like there's kinds out there. I mean, you know, my 7-year-old boy can take a million critters, and he can put those million critters in the right trash can, the right 5 or 6 trash can. You know, fish, bird, amphibian, I mean, that's not hard. It looks like there's kinds out there with no intermediates. I mean, how many intermediates are there really around that are going to give you a problem? Maybe a handful, 4 or 5, a platypus, and some other things. But anyway, no one has a problem with it. So virtually every human being has always thought it looked designed, which is interesting. Because what Darwin is actually doing in his project here is he's giving an explanation for how it can look designed and not be. Okay? How does this work? Well, it's natural selection that removes these. These aren't viable. So it looks like there's gaps between fish, amphibians, birds, and mammals. But see, there really isn't in your theory of nature. Okay? Now, what difference does this move make? Well, everything. Here's why. Let's grant that Darwin's right, that you can get increased, I'll grant Darwin that he can end up with increasing diversity over time, and natural selection can happen on those organisms, and you can get new species. Now, there's problems in there to be sorted out, but I'll grant him all of that. My position is, even granting him all of that, his argument for this, up at the level of fish, amphibian, bird, mammal, depends on this theory of nature being true. Okay? Let me show you why. And show you in fact, that he did make it. What Darwin says in his book is, okay, we know this is true. Well, now, give me 1,000 generations and I think you'll get a genera. Give me 1,000,000 generations and I think you'll get a class. Okay? Now, what grounds does he have for making that extrapolation? And that is an extrapolation. What ground? What justification did he give in his book? Zero. He gave no justification, no argument for this position whatsoever. He didn't even talk about this. Because, see, it was a philosophical assumption that underlie the whole argument. And very few people saw. So they were talking past each other with regard to kinds in your theory of nature. So, what's the effect of this? There was somebody who very insightfully, as usual, well, the person who was insightful was Mark Twain. Mark Twain got a hold of this, and I'm going to read the whole thing. It's a little bit long. But Mark Twain put his finger on this exactly. I don't know if all of you know this or not, but he was a riverboat captain. And he spent years as a riverboat captain on the Mississippi from New Orleans up to at least Illinois. And over a period of years, they noticed that the length of the river changed. Because they'd know what the length of the river was, because they know how fast they were going, they knew how much current they were going against, so they knew the distances between places, and over time those distances changed. So he knew that as a riverboat captain. Well, here's what he said. Now, if I want to be one of those ponderous scientific people, and led on to prove what has occurred in the remote past by what has occurred in a given period of time in the recent past, or what will occur in the far future by what has occurred in the last few years, what an opportunity here. Geology never had such a chance, nor such exact data to argue from, nor development from species either. Glacial epochs are great things, but they are vague, vague. Please observe. In the space of 176 years, the lower Mississippi has shortened itself 242 miles. That's an average of a trifle over 1 1/3 mile per year. Therefore, any calm person who's not blind or idiotic can see that in the old Silurian period, just 1,000,000 years ago next November, the lower Mississippi was upwards of 1,300,000 miles long, stuck out over the Gulf of Mexico like a fishing rod. By the same token, any person can see that 742 years from now, the lower Mississippi will only be 1 3/4 miles long, and Cairo, Illinois, and New Orleans will have joined their streets together and be plodding comfortably along under a single mayor and mutual board of alders. There's something fascinating about science. One gets such wholesale returns from conjecture out of such a trifling investment in fact. Okay? Well, what he's pointing at is just this problem. I mean, was that an outrageous extrapolation from 1,000 generations to 1,000,000 to just say, well, we saw it happening here at 1,000? Well, now just extrapolate 10,000 and then 1,000,000. We've got it. Well, he's right. If nature is this way, this is what the debate should be about. Is this theory of nature true? Okay? That's a philosophical issue. That's not a scientific issue. No sets of experiments, no number of observations is ever going to decide that. Observations and experiments are important, but they in themselves can never decide this issue. So if that's true, if Darwin's right about that assumption, then his theory's right. Now, objectors to Darwin over time have pointed at something here. They want to make a dichotomy between microevolution and macroevolution. Okay? Well, the problem with that is their intuition is right. That his problem is he's going from what looks like microevolution to macroevolution here. Okay? But if he's right about this, then there is no split between microevolution and macroevolution. If nature is totally continuous, then he's right. So to argue that there's a micro-macroevolution split that he's not seen, you're just talking past the guy. Because his philosophical assumption is that doesn't make any sense. That can't possibly be an objection to his theory. If this is true. Okay, do you follow that? Okay, so now what I want to just point out real quickly is, now what's the bottom? The bottom is actually Aristotle's classification. So why I put them together is we're starting from the same five critters. A fish, an amphibian, a reptile, a bird, and a mammal. What does Aristotle say about that? What Aristotle said is, well, these are kinds. So under fish, sure, we can have all kinds of fish that differ by degree. That's called genus species, according to Aristotle. What a genus is, a genus is the group that describes its common features. So, for instance, fish, scales, fins, those sorts of things. And then under fish, we can have all kinds of different kinds of fish that all differ by degree. So the point is for any organism you're going to pick, it seems to me both of these theoretical frameworks, both of these theories of how to explain the data can actually explain it equally well. Okay, do you follow what I'm saying? So the fact that scientists keep pointing it, well, we get new species all the time down here. Well, so what? Okay, that isn't definitive in separating out the difference between Aristotle's view and Darwin's view. Both of those theories can account for all of the facts basically equally well. The issue is Aristotle right that there are real kinds in nature? Is it the case that human beings are a kind separate from the rest of the animal kingdom? Is that a true claim or is it not a true claim? Well, again, that's a philosophical issue. There are experiments and observations to be brought to the issue, but we can't decide it on that basis alone. This is a philosophical debate about these two competing theories. So what am I saying here? What I'm saying is, I think biology is in the same place that astronomy was during the Copernican Revolution. Meaning, we have two theories that can equally account for all the observations, and there's no way to empirically tell them apart. So, and as I say, if we look at the Copernican Revolution, it's a combination of fact and theory. It took for a long period of time to sort that out. It seems to me we've made virtually no progress in the last 100 years sorting this out the same way, because we're not realizing what kind of questions are really at stake here. Okay, so I want to stop. Questions about this? Logan?
Let me see if I've got the Reader's Digest version this morning. It would say that the fish, amphibian, reptile labels are just convenient labels used to describe that level of complexity within the continuum.
Yeah, arbitrarily. Yeah, just arbitrarily.
But he's also claiming that as time advances, actual categories that are divisions between kinds will develop.
Yes, but they're only apparent.
They're only for a time.
Well, yeah. Well, because
if everything died off, then they wouldn't advance anymore. We would say, well, back there where everything died off, they stopped at having clear divisions between them.
Well, what he's saying is, think of a bush. Okay, you got branches growing out here all over the place like this. Okay. Well, what natural so it's all continuous. I mean, we would have all these. We'd have fish with legs and amphibians with fins and scales, and we'd have all that stuff, and they'd be around now, except for the fact that those aren't very competitive against the others. So, natural selection removes those and leaves an apparent gap. Okay, so how he's answering this question is, it looks like these are real kinds with gaps that are unbridgeable, like these. However, I gave you an account with just chance, some diversity, and natural selection. I can account for why that apparently looks that way. So it appears as if there's kinds, but they're not real. Okay, so that's how he answered the question. Is that getting at what you wanted?
Yeah. And then what? The other question I have is, what is this, why is it that time makes all things possible?
Well, because if down here it's possible to have these two species differentiate from here. Let me turn the question on you then. Why is it that you think there's any limit to that?
Well, it seems to be like some sort of magic to guarantee that more time produces more diversification just automatically, rather than the last one we saw is the last one we'll ever see.
Well, Darwin's explanation for that is because the climate, the environmental conditions are always changing. As you branch out, the environment is constantly changing. Therefore, you're going to get change.
But shouldn't that change be a narrowing, not an opening of the bush? Because it seems to me all natural selection does over time is just eliminate.
Natural selection does, yes. And one of the problems for Darwin was, one, what accounts for this diversity and what maintains that diversity. Now, actually, in Darwin's lifetime, that was a problem. And as I said, I was going to grant Darwin all those things. And even if I granted them all to him, it still wouldn't work. But in this, here's one of them that doesn't work. See, at the time Darwin wrote the first edition, I think his book went through 18 editions. If I remember right. And in his first edition, he held to a theory of heredity called blending, which just means the two parents, all their stuff blends. Well, if that's true, then you can't maintain diversity. Everything's going to go to the middle. You're not going to be able to maintain any diversity. So in his first edition, what he claimed was inherent in an organism itself, in the face of changing environment, there's something in that organism that'll just force it to diversify. That's what he said. Now, in later editions, he actually held Lamarck's theory of use and disuse. So later on in some of the editions, he actually said, you know, the idea that a blacksmith can herk up and pass that on to his kids. Well, he accepted that view for a while. Well, in his lifetime, there never was a good explanation for how you maintain that diversity. You're right, natural selection only narrows. So, but from his perspective, there's something that gives an incremental diversity to it. Now, that got married with Mendel in his genetics, basically in the 20th century, and that's called the neo-Darwinian synthesis. That's what's accepted as Darwinian evolution in the 20th century. So when people say Darwinian evolution, 99 times out of 100, they mean the neo-Darwinian synthesis that's taking Mendel's genetic theory and blending that with Darwin's theory of natural selection. So that Mendel's theory gives us a view that there's genes, that there's particles that actually get passed. They either get passed or don't. And there's things like dominant and recessive. So that helps you maintain the diversity and create the diversity. Okay? So you're right. In Darwin's theory, there has to be two things. One force giving you the diversity that generates the diversity, and then natural selection is going to hone it down. That's correct. You're right. He never really himself figured that out. But the neo-Darwinian synthesis supposedly solved that problem. Now, what I want to say is, yeah, there's a number of problems down there. But my fundamental problem is the same one Mark Twain had, is that this project fails from square one in its central, in a central assumption. It only works given this assumption. Now, wow, time's going. Okay, this gets married with Francis Crick and the discovery of DNA. What do they say about that? Well, what they say now is all biology can be accounted for by these gene sequences, this molecular sequence. What are they really doing? They're mirroring what's called reductionism with this nominalism. So what you get is a position that says, ultimately, in biology, all there are is gene sequences. Married with this idea that there's no real kinds, you've got this picture. Infallibly. I mean, if that assumption's right, then they're home free. And biology, in fact, does reduce to chemistry and physics, meaning there's nothing unique about human life at all. What's happening to the rocks out on Spencer Butte, it's fundamentally no different from what's happening in a living organism, because life is not unique in this view. Because if you're saying something's unique now, then the word unique means kind. As soon as you, if the word unique is in your vocabulary, you're trying to signify a kind. So Darwin's very careful, but he's not completely off the hook. But anyone who uses the word unique has just described a kind. So anyone who's going to hold that position can't ever have that in their vocabulary. So life can't be unique. So, in fact, so they've gone farther and essentially now with Crick and Watson marrying that concept with this. So now, see, they say, well, DNA proves that this is true. Well, it doesn't do any such thing. You've still got the same problem. Genetic sequences, I mean, it might even be the Marxist view that's right. I mean, most of them don't even deal with that possibility that if you change enough genetic sequence here, you could get a saltation, a jump to something else. Well, if that's possible, that's Marxism. That's not Darwin. Darwin was very explicit that all this happens through very gradual steps. Okay? Yeah, Tim.
It looks like actually, then you can't have a brain evolve to another kind, like an animal evolve. Because once it mutates to a certain point, it's going to get selected out, so it never can cross over.
Well, what he says is, look, we'll start out with one species here, and over time, we sort of get one that's here now and over here. So these now, we'll call them different species, but that's just a convenient label. That's not a kind. They don't differ by having a unique quality to them.
Yeah, but was he implying that one kind could become another kind?
Well, he's saying one category, one species can become another species, but what do we mean by species? It's just a label.
Never right. To 1,000 generations, because once they mutate so far, then they're going to
right.
die off or whatever.
Well,
so
yeah, some of them
not become an animal because it's
yes.
It only goes so far before it dies out.
Right. And see, what's interesting in this already was Darwin said there's between 1 and 5 organisms. He implied animals, so he wasn't even talking about plants. So in his view of evolution, it wasn't about animals evolving from plants. That's not even in there. Both he and Lyell would hold the same view on that. And that would be, well, that's not a scientific question. That would be their response to that. You know, to raise the issue of the origin of plants or animals, well, that's beyond science. That's, you know, something else. History, but so they were trying to tightly define science. But see, the problem is if this is your view, then there's nothing that would ultimately say it couldn't happen, because those are all that exists are individuals. All these categories that we make, those aren't real. So there's no such thing as a species, no such thing as a class called fish. It's just a convenient word we put on this group of stuff. Group of organisms. That's all it is. Yeah, Jody.
So is the force of diversification an irresistible one, such that you'll never return back to the original egg you got there? And if that's the case, is the whole concern about endangered species meant to Darwin?
Okay. Big question. And actually, some of that comes up in the next 2 weeks, where I'm doing environmental ethics. Okay. Okay, so your question was, once it diversifies, can it ever come back? Basically, he says that it would be virtually impossible for that to happen. Because it's just chance alone. And the fact that it already, natural selection, that you had the diversity in existence, but natural selection removed those. So what was originally there, yes, would become extinct. So yes. His point was that all new what we call species originated from an older species, which may still be there or may just be gone. So that, yes, there's a continual replacement to this. So extinction is a very likely outcome of virtually all species, according to Darwin. So that part of your question, the answer to it would be yes, and you would not go back. The second part, I want to wait till a couple weeks, or next week.
Misinterpretation or something.
No.
It seems like there's something tangible there that
we're working
with, draw these conclusions from.
Okay. Let me start. Okay. Good question. So it seems like fossils could really help us sort it out. And they can, to a point. Mm-hmm. Okay, first, it seems to me, is you pretty much have to know what you're looking for before you go look. So, for example, if you're going to make an argument about has man evolved from something called Australopithecans you know, is man related to Australopithecans, which is a non-human form that's also related to apes. Okay, well, it seems to me that you would have to have sorted out before you even go look at anything at least some idea of what you're going to, how you're going to, at least what possibilities exist out here. So you have to sort of have some kind of notion of what you're looking for first.
Like in the sense of like body dimension?
Well,
like that,
possibly, but I don't want to go too far because you can't say much of anything until you look at some specimens. Okay, so you have to look at some specimens to sort this out. But just looking at specimens and taking measurements, you're never going to answer this question. Do you see that point?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, okay, so Darwin said you get gradual change over time. Okay? Let's think about the fossil record. Think about just today. How many individual organisms, and let's just stick with vertebrates. Think of how many individual vertebrates exist in the world today. How many of them are going to die in a place that they could end up being deposited in something that's going to allow a fossil to form? Pretty darn small. Okay? Now, what are the chances that today, or later on, let's say even 1,000 years from now, let's say we got fossils very rapidly created here. Okay, what are the chances that a particular rock layer is going to be on the surface and somebody find that particular fossil? Okay, now, how many possible surfaces of that kind have soil, dirt, and trees on them, so you'll never see them? How many of them are under the water? Do you begin to see the problem here? Even if we found every fossil that existed, what are we going to have? We're going to have huge gaps in this thing. I mean, it's going to be spotty. It's going to be coarse. It will never show gradual evolution. Even if you had every fossil that was possible, it would still be too coarse. So it seems to me that fossils are never going to be the kind of thing that are going to get you where what you want. It's never going to give you this continuous night-tight picture without any missing links, without any jumps of, you know, it just depends on who's looking at it, how big a jump it is. So potential, the fossil record is very important, but again, it's not going to sort it out itself. And it depends a lot about what assumptions you're bringing, what you're going to see in it.
Yeah, I guess the fossil that comes to mind about this is the
Archaeopteryx. Archaeopteryx, uh-huh.
And it's just like, I mean,
well,
but, just, I don't know how to interpret that.
Okay, well, the Archaeopteryx, it looks like a reptile, but it has perfect feathers on it. Now, what are we going to say about Archaeopteryx? Is that an intermediate form between reptiles and birds? See, I would argue it's not. Here's why. It's just an individual that has some characteristic of reptiles and some characteristics of birds. Okay, it's an anomaly. Aristotle recognized there were anomalies. Okay, what would count as an intermediate? Find a reptile like Archaeopteryx that does not have completely developed feathers, but scales that are halfway developed into feathers. If you find one of those, now you're beginning to point at that the category reptile and the category bird is not a kind. If you find one of those, you found something important. Okay? Now, if we find one, we got the issue of, is this just some kind of malady that we just happened to find or what? I mean, see, the point is, is the facts aren't going to decide this easily in the end. This isn't largely about facts. But if you found one of those, that would be important, because that would signify that it looks like then that there were intermediates between reptiles and birds. So if you ever found one of those, that would be very insightful. Have there any been found between any of these? None that I can see.
So you're saying octopus is more like a platypus?
Yeah. That, you know, it's a mammal that lays eggs, and it's got a duck bill. Well, it's an anomaly. You know, it doesn't fit the categories, but it's not an intermediate form. It's not an intermediate form with regards to, you know, development. I mean, if you want an intermediate form, it's got to have, for the key features, it's got to have an intermediate for those key features.
Just out of curiosity, when they try to breed different kinds, or kinds that have tried to do that?
All kinds of them. Well, yes. And but what you raise is actually a very, well, is another one of these. I mean, we're just starting to peel the onion here. Like I said, if you just grant Darwin what he wants, the project doesn't work. But in this that you granted him, there's a lot of problems. Okay, one is, yeah, how are we going to define what a species is or a kind or whatever? See, what you're proposing is an empirical definition, that we're going to use the test of whether they can breed or interbreed as a definitive test for whether something is a kind or not. Well, that's a philosophical commitment about what a kind is. Is that justified or not justified? Or do you need rational grounds for what a kind is? Aristotle argued for rational kinds. Because the problem is, if you're going to use whether they can successfully breed or not, and that's going to be your criteria for if it's a species, what happens if the individual you got happens to be sterile? I mean, if something's sterile, are you going to call it not a species of anything? See, if your criterion is empirical alone, like breeding, then you got a problem, it seems to me. So even it, I mean, even these kinds of questions, like I say, there's an onion to get peeled here.
These geneticists that have married DNA attributes of like insects and other things back over. I mean, is that the sort of thing that like they're going, since we genetically we can do this, there is an ultimate nominalism in nature because of this?
Well, again, that in itself is a philosophical commitment. I mean, there's a set of philosophical commitments on either side of how you're going to answer that issue.
So, I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, is it that sort of stuff that muddies the water?
Well, it muddies, well, it appears to muddy the water, but it only muddies the water because we've never clarified what the question is and what kind of grounds it would actually take to sort this thing out. That's at least my perspective, is that it muddies it simply because we've never clarified what the issue is we need to look at and how we would look at it and what it looks like out there. Nobody's doing any of that. So, as I say, it seems like the actual issues themselves are, no one's talked about them. Well, virtually no one has talked about them in the last 150 years, as far as I can see. There's been very, very little discussion about the real things we need to sort out here to figure out what really is the answer, whichever side you sit on. Logan. Well, I can't speak, you know, to what motivates individuals, but I mean, as I say in the beginning, if there wasn't really important major issues for human beings involved in this, I think it would get sorted out a lot easier and we wouldn't care anything about it in the end, because it would just be, biologists sorting out biology for biology's sake. So, I mean, I think if the question stayed there, we might have more hope of making progress. But see, part of it is, I think, on both sides, it's not really being honest about what this is really about. Now, sometimes it is. Sometimes it's very, people are explicit about what the issue is. But it seems to me that, I said it last week and I'll say it again, is, now, I mean, I think you can tell this isn't my position today, but it seems like it's perfectly plausible to me that someone could be a biblical Christian and accept Darwin's theory of evolution, that there's a way those things could go together and fit together philosophically. I'm saying it might be plausible. I think it is plausible that that's a possibility. So it seems to me that whatever the answer is here, this isn't going to definitively answer whether there's a God or not. And the only reason people think it does is because they can see the implications of where Darwin's going, but don't recognize that the foundation it sits on is actually this over here, not the facts of what he presented. So is that getting at your question?
It just seems to me that there's, I discern a lack of scientific skepticism in the field. When someone jumps up and says, aha, I have another proof of whatever,
mm-hmm.
you know, cold fusion, for example.
Right.
I mean, physicists came down on that guy like a ton of bricks.
Right.
And, but produces some enzyme in a laboratory somewhere, under carefully controlled, directed circumstances, he jumps up and says, aha, proof that evolution has occurred. And the rest of the scientists applaud him
mm-hmm.
instead
of right.
coming down on him like a ton of bricks. You know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
Where's the guy that says, show me?
Right. Well, that was actually, there were two major impediments I wanted to talk about tonight. And I actually chewed up all my time here talking about the first one. But actually, what you're raising is the second one. And I want to do like a two or three-minute version of this just to give you. And this is my struggle with this, largely. I mean, I've been interested in science since I was a little kid. And, you know, by the time I was in second or third grade, I knew I was going to do biology at the graduate level. So, and, yeah, well, in fact, this is one of those bad stories, but you know that large piece of paper with the lines that you first learned to print on? Mm-hmm. When I was in first grade, you had to write your first sentence, and the first sentence was what you wanted to be when you grew up, and I wrote, I wanted to be an ichthyologist, and I spelled it right, and my first grade teacher was, well, I come from a long line of teachers, including my mother. And, you know, so teacher said, I didn't have a clue what it was. I had to go look it up in the dictionary. But anyway, so my mom has that frame that I'm one of those weirdos that just sort of knew what I wanted to do. But my problem was, as I say, I don't know why, but when I read those two books, see, here's the view of science I had that I got from kindergarten, and I was now on my way to be a PhD student at one of the couple leading ecological schools in the country. Science is a method. By doing the method, it sets aside human biases, and by using statistics to set aside human judgment, so that we now just use statistics to decide whether we're going to accept or reject, we remove even judgment from it. And we submit those to journals that peer review them. That is what science is. And because of that process, some would argue, the strong argument is that science is value-free. That there's this dichotomy between facts and values. And the scientific method separates those values out. So science is unique. At the beginning of the 20th century, there was a view called scientism. The proponents of these were largely logical empiricists or logical positivists. Their view was that's the only form of knowledge that exists is science, done by the scientific method. Now, that was a very commonly held view at the beginning of the century, and that's held by a majority of scientists I work with yet today. Now, many of them might not say it's the only form of knowledge, but it's certainly privileged knowledge. So, if you ask the question now with regard to issues like this, who wears the final robes of authority in this culture for what's a fact? Scientists. Okay, so it's the scientists that need to sort out this debate. And it's that group of peers that need to authenticate this. Well, and last week I read Galileo's response to the church. See, to me, going back to peer review is basically the medieval model of knowledge, of how you justify and ground the authority of your knowledge. Because what was the medieval church's argument against the Copernicans? Their argument was, explicitly a guy named Sarcey made it. He said, well, look, Galileo, it's been 60 years since Copernicus wrote his theory, and you gained virtually no followers. You know, your peers don't buy it. So therefore, we conclude that theory must not be a good one because you didn't convince them that your theory was right. Well, and last week I read his reply. And the short answer is he's saying the authority of science rests with the individual. That individual looks at the facts, uses his own reasons, and ascertains what's true, the better theory, and what's not. Galileo was saying the same thing Luther was saying. Okay. Most people would say that move with regard to the authority of knowledge, those moves were the move out of the Middle Ages into the modern period. And so that's a hallmark of the rise of the modern period, is where does the authority rest? And in the Enlightenment, it was with the individual. And in the modern period, what we've done is we've reverted back to the medieval model, we've just substituted one priesthood for another. So we're looking at the same thing. So to wrap up and this could be much longer, but to wrap this up, see, that was my struggle. So the issue is, well, how about that? I mean, can you justify that position that science is a method? And I've argued now twice that you can't. No justification for that position has ever been given. So anyone who would define science as a method that's going to give you privileged information or higher, no one's ever given a defense for that yet. So on those grounds, a scientist has no greater grounds to take a position or to say anything than a natural historian. Now, so with regard to this issue, should scientists then not be around the table? No, I'm not saying that. They have a place. I mean, the empirical evidence here is important, but none of this is going to get decided on empirical evidence, and they should be the minority of people. That's the minority part of the conversation. The conversation is really, where are those astute people who understand the philosophical issues and philosophically can work their way to the solution to these questions? Where are those people? Well, I haven't seen them in the last 150 years around any table. Now, they're scattered in books and around, but they don't sit at those tables because they aren't invited. Those folks aren't invited. Anyway, that could be a longer conversation, but the whole issue then of what is science and what its role in culture, that's been a live issue for me for the last 30 years, trying to figure it out and being a scientist. So, yeah.
Well, with science, method, as long as the method's tangible, instead of just like Darwin saying, this little chunk of my method is tangible, but then the rest of his method was, now you just take it out a thousand generations, and there you've gone to the intangible.
Well, there you have, but let me give you another example and see what you think of this one. Go to the top of Spencer Butte a little bit before dawn. Watch this. Okay. What do you see? You see the sunrise, right?
Yeah.
Why do you hold Copernicus's view and not Ptolemy's? Because your experience is telling you the sun rises. You're sitting still. So if experience is your ultimate arbiter, then why aren't you a Ptolemaic astronomer? Because I'll bet everybody in this room would stand on that mountain and watch the sun come up. You're not moving. The sun is. So on what grounds are you claiming Ptolemy is wrong?
Someone else's experiments showing that we're actually...
Well, see, now we've got other reasons, but if you're sitting at the time of Copernicus, there is no other empirical data. They're making a different kind of argument that their theory is nonetheless true, and it's science. So if we're going to call the Copernicans the founders of modern science, science is not an empirically grounded method. Empiricism can't be our ultimate ground for it, because if empirical evidence is your ultimate ground for it, then why did anybody hold a Copernican view at that time? Because there was no empirical evidence that could separate the two theories out. But all the Copernicans, Galileo, Kepler, and Copernicus were all arguing their theory was true in spite of the fact that they did not have empirical data to prove it. So Francis Bacon, even, the founder of modern empirical science, what did he initially say? The Copernicans are wrong because they got no empirical evidence. But it seems to me the foundation of modern science, all you got to do is look at Copernicus, Galileo, and Kepler, and you're not going to ground it on empirical grounds. That you can't define science as just being based on observation and experiment. That kind of a definition isn't going to fly. But that was the definition the philosophers of science, they said for 500 years science has been defined as hypothesis testing, empirical evidence. Well, that's just a fantasy. It's not true. Because the Copernicans didn't ground science on those grounds. None of them. So...
Well, no one believed them either,
but nonetheless, they were right. But the issue is, were they justified in claiming their theory was true? So see, now, what are we going to say about that as far as science is concerned? Was it science they did? And if it's not science, what was it that they did? What were they doing? If that's not science, what category are we going to put it in? So, and again, no experiment here, no set of measurements, no... taking measurements is going to solve these kind of issues. Those aren't the people that ought to be sitting around the table at all in this kind of an issue. And they're the only people sitting around the table because of the role that science has been given in the culture. Yeah?
Just a short, quick question for you. How much complicate your own personal philosophy of biology by adding a little dose of spirituality to it?
How much did it complicate it? Well, I'm not sure how to answer that. I guess I would say that, somewhere in the mix, I'm not exactly sure where I became a believer. That's part of the problem in how to answer this. But coming to these kind of conclusions about science, as you might expect, cost me a PhD in science at Oregon State. In the end, it might not have had to. In other words, they asked for an answer, and I gave them a fuller answer than I now realize they were asking me. So you know, in part I made life a little harder on myself than I might have needed to. But it's continually a struggle, because if you view science as something other than collecting data, running the appropriate statistical tests, submitting those to a journal, and having them peer-reviewed, you're going to have a hard time having anyone pay much attention to what you say in most arenas. So, for instance, all government... Well, I work in salmon, in watershed kind of restoration, that sort of stuff. It was interesting. I mean, you see interesting things like the Oregon Cattlemen's Association sponsoring a bill in the Oregon legislature defining science as hypothesis testing. Now, what is that about? Well, what that's about is, if you define it as hypothesis testing and you don't have any data, then there's no evidence that anything you're doing is causing any kind of problems. So you're going to get all kinds of political solutions to problems like that. So on one end, you get those kinds of issues. But the other thing is the scientific community hangs on to that authority they have tenaciously. So, for example, when any major policy question comes up, there's peer-reviewed journal science, and then there's what's called gray literature. And that's what they mean. Peer-reviewed journal science and gray literature. And 95% of what I've done is gray literature. And so it can't be even brought into the debate. Now, it nonetheless finds its way in here and there. So it isn't that black and white. It has made life a little harder in some respects, but on the other hand, it's made it so much... I mean, I'm 10 times the scientist I ever would have been doing it the other way. So, I mean, for me, it's been a benefit. So, see, it's hard to answer that. So, that's not a very good answer to your question, but that's the best I can do. Other ones? We should wrap it up here in a minute or so. Yeah?
Your comment about the fossil record maybe not being particularly helpful in the whole discussion, would that be held true by both sides?
Well,
another kind of gravitating more to the fossil
record? I would say it pretty much holds to both sides. Both sides have based a lot on the fossil record. Both sides would argue, again, it comes down to arguing one set of facts against the other set of facts, and it misses the point. Yeah, and to me, the whole thing misses the point. It's kind of like, it's kind of like dueling Bible verses about something, where people are just pulling them off and you count up who's got the most, and that's how you're making a decision about X, Y, or Z. I mean, it's that kind of thing. That's the way it strikes me. The fossil record, to my knowledge, at this point, I'm not aware of any single specimen that would really help us sort out Darwin's perspective versus Aristotle's perspective. I'm not aware of one single fossil that is really illustrative in differentiating which one of those two theories might be true. So there's no data from the fossil record that would support one over the other, it seems to me at this point. Nobody's been able to show me one yet.
So to clarify, sides do value the fossil record more highly?
Both sides do.
Yeah.
Yes, both sides do. Yeah, because again, I think the error is both sides are committed to this view of science, that science is a method and it's an argument about facts. That it's the scientists that have to decide this based on the facts. That's what I'm saying is that perspective is just dead on arrival. That's going to get us nowhere with regard to these kind of issues. It hasn't gotten us anywhere yet. And as I say, the error is on both sides. Because in part, look at what intelligent design was aimed at. They wanted to get a conversation in the scientific community around peer review of their theory. I mean, Michael Behe is a microbiologist. He's a scientist. And so he got taken to the cleaners immediately. First question out of the attorney's mouth when he got cross-examined: how many peer review papers do you have on intelligent design in the journals? There's question one. I mean, it got ugly. And they just rolled over because they weren't going to challenge that. No one's going to challenge that. And so a response, so, I mean, I've written a couple books on these things, on this issue now, and the only comment I got from the Discovery Institute in Seattle is their comment was basically, my perspective is not helpful to them. And it's not. Because, see, if your goal is to have that conversation, to elevate intelligent design theory and have a conversation in the intelligent about the facts of the matter conducted by scientists, that's the agenda that they've been aiming at, it sure looks like to me. And so when I say these kind of things, they're like, we don't need this kind of help, because that makes it impossible to talk to scientists. It's not helping them in their agenda of starting a dialogue with science, is what they, that was the goal. So that's right. And so it seems to me they're as committed to that view as the other side, and I think neither one of those views are justifiable. No defense has ever been given of those positions, and it's the impediment that's keeping us from ever making any progress on these issues. So, anything else? Well,
one thing I was going to ask about is fossil record. I asked you last week about it also. I think that generally the creation scientist's assumption is that the fossil record would be link heavy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the bird,
mm-hmm.
the reptile thing.
Yeah.
That people look at. But wouldn't our modern fauna and flora be link heavy? As the same kind of proof or disproof.
Well, link heavy.
There should be crossover species all over the place today.
That's why they were punctuated equilibrium.
Well, yeah, in part that was right. And, you know, well, it's time to go. I mean, I'll comment on that and continue to talk about that. But yeah, that actually was one of the issues that really got me thinking about this issue long before I was a Christian. But when Niles Eldridge and Stephen J. Gould published their paper on punctuated equilibrium, what they're basically saying is that it looks like species don't change for a long time, and then all of a sudden there's a jump. Now, in Darwin's theory, it's gradual evolution. He says over and over and over again, there are no jumps, there are no leaps. So, So they went on to explain how you get this. But what was interesting to me was, well, wait a minute. Probably the two leading paleontologists alive today are proposing this kind of theory. I mean, why would they be proposing a theory like this? And the only explanation I could come up with is because that's what the record looks like. I mean, if it didn't look like that, why would they propose it? So, I mean, when they published that, it was like, well, what evidence is there? And, yeah, that was a problem for them. And as I say, that was my first problem of where I went, wait a minute. I mean, there's something askew here if the two leading paleontologists alive right now are proposing this kind of a theory. Why? So anyway, so there's no small amount of irony that it's Niles Eldridge and Stephen Jay Gould that, you know, basically started me on this journey. And so they're the ones that instigated it, in a sense.
Is that the Marxist view?
Well, it's actually not. You can go. We'll wrap it up. But I'll tell you the answer to it if you want. It's actually not a Marxist view. A lot of people interpret it as a Marxist view, but it's really not. And I'll explain it in a minute, but I'll wrap it up and take the mic off, and everybody can leave who wants to leave.
Okay.